Hello, welcome to our program on careers. I'm Irene Lubin, a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. I would like to begin today's program with an article which appeared in the New York Times on the 6th of June of this year. The title of this article is Bleak Job Market Could Leave Deep Scars on New Graduates. This article was written for the New York Times by Sydney Ember. A hiring downturn compounded by the rise of artificial intelligence risks loss of opportunities, earnings, and even of employment. Young college graduates are facing a gloomy economic future. Confronting the toughest job market since the depths of the pandemic, they are likely to make less money in the long term and have more trouble advancing their careers, economists are warning. The rise of artificial intelligence also poses a new threat to the kinds of entry-level knowledge jobs that young graduates have long sought, which could further scramble employment prospects and upend their career trajectories. The result is that the current crop of recent graduates could be left with deep scars that include a reduction in earnings, diminished employment opportunities, and even widespread job displacement. There are going to be lasting effects of this, said Lisa Kahn, who is an economist at the University of Rochester. The cohorts that were lucky enough to just finish a little bit earlier on or a little bit later, I think, are going to be doing better. The full impact of graduating into this hiring downturn will not come into focus for years, of course, and much remains uncertain, especially about AI's role. But history does suggest that there is still trouble ahead for young graduates these days. Economists have broadly found that workers who graduate from college during bad economies fare worse in the long run than their more fortunate counterparts. In a seminal paper that tracked recent graduates before, during, and after the recession in the early 1980s, Ms. Kahn found that graduating from college in a bad economy has a long-run negative impact on wages. Though she found that the effects faded over time, a gap did persist even 15 years later, long after the economy had recovered from that downturn. A reduction in wages occurs partly because recessions affect the quality and availability of early career job opportunities, an in-depth 2012 study did find, because larger higher-paying firms reduce their hiring during bad economies, many recent graduates end up taking positions at smaller, lower-paying firms at first. That thins their resumes and makes it harder for them to move up the ladder to better-paying jobs. Workers who graduated from less prestigious schools or with majors that usually lead to lower-paying jobs in the first place are at a disadvantage, the study found. During recessions, good employers stop hiring, said Till Van Wachter, an economist at the University of California in Los Angeles and an author of the 2012 study. There is a lot of friction in the labor market, so you never quite make it back up to the top of the queue. The latest group of college graduates is likewise encountering an economy in flux. Slow hiring for much of the past 2 years, coupled with a reluctance from employers to fire workers, has led to broad stasis that has hurt new entrants into the labor market, a group that includes young degree holders. The unemployment rate for college graduates ages 22 to 27 has been up sharply in the last 3 years and stood at 5.6% in the first quarter of the year, according to an analysis from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. More than 40% of those who are employed are working in jobs that do not require a college degree. The overall labor market is not in a recession right now, said Larry Katz, labor economist at Harvard, but it is clearly feeling like a recession for young college graduates entering the labor market. The unemployment rate for recent college graduates is not quite as bad as it got during the Great Recession or during the recession in the early 1980s, Mr. Katz noted, but it is higher than during the recessions in the 1990 to 91 and after the dot-com crash back in 2000. He said that he was worried that the rise in remote work since the pandemic meant that young graduates, when they did find work, would have fewer opportunities for training and mentorship, further destabilizing their careers. Employers may also be reluctant to hire young graduates because it is more difficult for managers to mentor and train less experienced employees remotely, according to research firm economists at the New York Fed, the University of Virginia, and at Harvard. That could help to explain the post-pandemic rise in the unemployment rate for young graduates, they found. As in the past, the tough job market is forcing many new degree holders to recalibrate their job searches and enter careers they had not even considered. Many are settling for jobs that do not require a bachelor's degree, and others are foregoing employment entirely and instead opting for graduate school. Accordingly, today's young graduates might be expected to experience ill effects similar to those faced by their unlucky predecessors during typical economic slumps. Adding to the uncertainty for young job seekers these days is that it is too early to know whether the elevated unemployment rate for new college graduates is caused by a cyclical downturn in hiring, or is the start of an alarming trend brought on by artificial intelligence. So far, artificial intelligence has not wreaked havoc on the labor market despite dire predictions, and it is possible that it will have limited effects on opportunities for recent college graduates. Other scenarios present a more ominous picture, however. Under one, companies continue to hire reluctantly as they work to figure out just how to deploy the technology, which would hamper the ability of young graduates to switch jobs and to raise the risk of getting stuck on the employment ladder. Artificial intelligence could also replace some high-skill college-educated employees who instead take lower-skill, lower-paying jobs. The shift would then push less-advantaged workers further down the job hierarchy and depress wages overall. If AI does begin to automate entry-level work en masse, these young college graduates could be disproportionately and more permanently harmed. If it really does differentially affect entry-level jobs relative to others, then potentially you have a cycle that is much harder for entry-level workers relative to the experienced workers than it has been in the past, said Jesse Rothstein, who is a professor of public policy and economics at the University of California in Berkeley. That would have larger scarring effects as a result. Even if artificial intelligence does not vaporize jobs, the most recent degree holders could encounter a different challenge. Many graduated right before schools began teaching the technology in earnest, and as a result of this, employers may view this current group of graduates as less attractive than those who will graduate with more AI skills even a year or two later. Still, young graduates generally do better in the labor market than people without a college education, especially during economic downturns. Though the gap has narrowed in recent years, the unemployment rate for recent college graduates is still lower than it is for all young workers. They are still doing much better than if they hadn't gone to college at all, said Ms. Khan, the University of Rochester economist. And that is an important part of the narrative that people sometimes miss. The next article that I would like to read for you today comes from the Wall Street Journal, the 15th of June. The title of this article is, "Does Remote Work Make Employees Happier?" Here's what the evidence says. This article was written for the Wall Street Journal by Andrew Blackman. In general, workers like hybrid schedules, but it isn't always that simple. Some years ago, a great experiment began in workplaces across the globe. Office workers did their jobs from home before the pandemic, of course, but never so many and for so long. And now, after 6 years, it is time to ask a fundamental question. Does remote work make people happy? The short answer, academic research shows that although working from home a couple of days a week boosts job satisfaction and makes employees less likely to quit, full-time remote work is more likely to make people anxious and lonely. There seems to be a Goldilocks effect with remote work and happiness, says Adolfo Cuevas, who is Associate Professor of Social and Behavioral Sciences at New York University. Working from home some of the time provides flexibility and work-life balance benefits without the social isolation that can accompany being fully remote. Dig deeper into the numbers, however, and the picture becomes more complicated, detailing who likes and who doesn't like remote work and why, and how employers can help their workers enjoy the benefits of working from home while minimizing the downsides. So, here's a closer look at what we know so far about the impact of remote work on happiness and job satisfaction. Hybrid work makes employees happier. After the COVID-19 pandemic and lockdowns, Americans' workers' relationship with the office was never quite the same. About a quarter of all U.S. workdays are now worked from home, about three times pre-COVID levels of remote work, according to data from the Survey of Working Arrangements and Attitudes, which is a monthly online survey of 5,000 U.S. workers run jointly by economists at Stanford University, the Autonomous Technological Institute of Mexico, known as ITAM, and the University of Chicago. Mostly, that is a good thing for employees. Nicholas Bloom, an economics professor at Stanford University, conducted a six-month research study involving 1,612 employees of technology company Trip.com. He and his colleagues separated employees randomly into two groups, with one group working 5 days a week in the office and the other working 2 days a week from home. The results were conclusive. Job satisfaction improved significantly for the hybrid workers, and quit rates dropped by a third. The benefits of hybrid work were particularly strong for women and for people with longer commutes. The trial was so successful that the company rolled out the hybrid work schedule to everybody, Bloom says. Employees loved the flexibility of working from home, and they saved on average 3 hours a week from not having to commute. Zoe Cullen, who is Associate Professor of Business Administration at Harvard University, found that U.S. technology workers were willing to accept a 25% pay cut for partly or fully remote roles. And Bloom's research also found that desired work-from-home rates exceed actual rates, especially for women and workers with young children. But fully remote work doesn't. If 2 days of remote work make employees happier, companies might be tempted to go fully remote and capture even more benefits. However, the research suggests that as employees work from home more often, the benefits of flexibility start to be outweighed by downsides like loneliness and anxiety. Cuevas and colleagues at NYU analyzed data from the Household Pulse Survey, a regular survey of thousands of U.S. adults run by the Census Bureau, to see the effect of remote work on people's risk of depression, anxiety, and loneliness. They found that working remotely up to 4 days a week slightly lowered the risk of depression, but doing so for 5 days a week put workers at higher risk of anxiety, and loneliness increased for people working from home at least 3 days a week. It might be an optimal arrangement for employees to work from home 1 to 2 days a week, where they maintain productivity, maintain mental health, and still attain the social connectedness they need, said Cuervas. He says fully remote workers miss the daily social interactions associated with the workplace, not just meetings with coworkers, but also informal interactions like small talk with the barista at their favorite coffee shop on the way to work. Now, research by Christos Makridis, associate research professor at Arizona State University, and Jason Schlotzer of Georgetown University, also shows the limits of remote work in fostering job satisfaction. They crunched the numbers on a pay scale survey of the remote work arrangements of nearly 165,000 employees and found that those who said they always or mostly work remotely were no happier than those who worked full-time in the office, and they were also more likely to consider leaving. The pluses and the minuses. Researchers in Europe have been running detailed studies to identify what aspects of remote work make people happier and which ones have a negative effect. Remote work makes employees happier by increasing productivity and making work more interesting, said Filippo Pustellaria, who is a lecturer in the Department of Management, Technology and Economics at ETH Zurich in Switzerland. Flexible working hours also help, but to a lesser degree. And on the negative side, remote workers suffer from a worse work-life balance and more difficult interactions with coworkers and supervisors. He reached those conclusions by analyzing data from an online survey of almost 2,000 graduates of professional colleges in Switzerland with co-researcher Thomas Boley of ZHAW School of Management and Law. The finding about increased productivity may come as a surprise to bosses who fret about what their employees are up to when they're out of sight, but Pustellaria thinks it's because remote workers can focus more on the task they have to complete, and their performance gives them higher pay that contributes to job satisfaction. As for more interesting work, Pustellaria explains that remote workers tend to have more flexibility to give priority to their work and more ability to focus on interesting tasks without being distracted by office chatter, dull meetings, and other features of office life. Pustellaria also found that although both men and women had higher job satisfaction from remote work, the flexibility of remote work was a stronger factor for women who carry more childcare and family responsibilities than men do. By contrast, younger workers are likely to be happier in the office, says Jim Hardest, who is Chief Scientist of Workplace Management and Well-being at Gallup. It's harder for them to learn the job and form social networks when working remotely. Home life also makes a difference. A worker living alone in a small apartment is less likely to be happy working from home than someone in a large house with a family who can take advantage of the flexibility of remote work while also having a dedicated space for work time. The time savings from remote work are a big draw. By analyzing data from the Survey of Working Arrangements and Attitudes, Bloom and colleagues found that people who have a longer commute and spend more time getting ready for work are more likely to want to work from home. Specifically, people who spent 1 hour a day on commuting and grooming wanted to work from home 1.5 days a week on the average, and that rose to almost 2 days a week for those who spent 2 hours a day. Remote work also appears to have some other unexpected effects. Bloom and his colleagues found that people who worked from home had more children and more future plans for their children than those who did not. And when both partners worked from home, the effect was even stronger. The creative deficit. Remote work may have a negative impact on creativity. Researchers in the Netherlands pored over the daily diaries of 112 hybrid workers in the UK to compare what they did on remote and on-site days. Although their core responsibilities were the same in both locations, the workers spent less time on extra role behaviors, such as helping co-workers and coming up with creative ideas on their remote working days. We know from a lot of creativity research that what you need for creativity is to talk to people and get different perspectives, says San Feenstra, who is an assistant professor of organizational psychology at Vrije Universiteit Amsterdam and a co-author of the study. It's actually quite hard to be creative when you're at home on your own. The reduction in extra role behaviors was driven not just by the technical challenges of remote work, but also by feeling less connected on remote work days. When human interaction decreases and you feel less connected, that also reduces satisfaction and engagement, she says. The role of leaders. So, what can companies do to get the benefits of remote work while minimizing the downsides? Another study by Feenstra shows that leaders can help remote teams maintain a shared sense of identity. They can do that by, among other things, creating opportunities for remote workers to meet in person, creating a set of team values based on employee discussions, and consistently reinforcing them, and talking about what we can do as a team instead of what I need you to do. The main challenge for companies is, even if some of our employees work remotely, how can we still have a shared identity as a company, as a team, Feenstra says. How can we still create a sense of us? Bloom says companies should encourage even fully remote workers to work in the office at least once a month so that they can connect with colleagues and avoid too much isolation. It's also important to coordinate schedules so that all remote and hybrid workers are in the office on the same day. Don't leave it up to employees to pick up their own days in the office, says Harder. You've got to organize certain days when you're going to have an office culture. Another key to happiness for remote workers is consistency. Once a company offers remote or hybrid work, people start to build their lives around the expectation that it will continue. Bloom has found that the share of employees living more than 50 miles from work has more than doubled since 2020. So, if the rules abruptly change, it's unlikely to be popular. A study at the University of Pittsburgh found that companies enforcing return-to-office mandates experienced a significant decrease in job satisfaction. The best remote work policies avoid one-size-fits-all mandates and try to accommodate employees' varying preferences. Some people prefer fully remote. Some people want to be in the office all the time. Others want hybrid, says Bloom. Choice is what makes people the happiest. Next, I would like to read from the Work Friend column in which Max Reed responds to questions from readers of the New York Times. This letter is from Anonymous. Their affair, my problem. I work on a team of three people at a nonprofit. I am relatively new, and I had struggles with my original two colleagues from the very start. They both let me know that I wasn't their top pick for their job and prevented me from working on any projects with them. I raised concerns with management repeatedly over the past year, and while they have recognized the situation is not ideal, they have not wanted to intercede. What's more, I have long suspected that these colleagues were having an affair, a suspicion that I kept to myself. Recently, in an effort to promote better relations between us, management sent us and another colleague on a work trip to Hawaii. This colleague and I discovered that the other two were spending large amounts of time not working, and we accidentally, when stopping by one of their condos for a planned dinner, overheard them clearly having relationships. This became one of many other signs of their physical intimacy that we witnessed on the trip. When we got back to work, my colleague and I chose to report our suspicions that they had been using company funds to pay for romantic getaways. Management did a broader investigation and found many months of financial problems relating to misuse of work funds. As a result, one of my colleagues was fired. The other, who was a long-standing, much beloved employee, remains employed but is extremely angry. Assuming she remains at the company, I will be expected to work with her. I believe she blames me for everything that has happened. We have no HR department, and I am at a loss for how to navigate this relationship. Any advice here? The response is, I wouldn't want to minimize an obviously stressful situation, but I hope you can recognize the silver lining here. Your vexing workplace drama is juicy. Still, there is obviously more to do than just laugh about it. In the absence of an HR department, a good rule of thumb for dealing with a hostile colleague is document everything. By document everything, I mean you should maintain both an email correspondence with her that can act as a written reference to any verbal agreements and a record of any difficult interactions with this colleague. It doesn't need to be a detailed diary with elaborate descriptions, just a running log with dates, times, witnesses, and a brief record of what was said. You may never need to refer to this documentation, but in the event her hostility tips into retaliation or harassment, you will want it. Before it gets to the point of conflict, though, you should also open up a line of communication with your bosses. You say they haven't wanted to intercede in the past, and while I can be sympathetic to their position, insofar as I too am sometimes lazy and avoidant, it's a dereliction of managerial duty for them to have allowed this kind of noxious dynamic to develop. At the same time, you might start to quietly send the resume around to other employees. The fact that your bosses were already declining to mediate your dysfunctional workplace relationship before the Hawaiian incident and are continuing to do so after an offense significant enough to get somebody fired should not fill you with confidence that they're going to have your back when the time comes. This is all the time we have on our program on careers for today. I hope that you've enjoyed listening in and will enjoy the rest of your day. And thank you for listening in. I'm Irene Lubin, a volunteer reader, and you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona.